Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Anjel Ellis. Anjel Ellis is the author of Arab on Radar, a book of poems published in 2007 by Six Gallery Press. Her poems have appeared in the anthologies Come Together, Imagine Peace, published by Bottom Dog Press, and Voices from the Attic, Volume 14, the latest work by Carlo University's Mad Women in the Attic. A 2008 recipient of an Individual Creative Artist Fellowship from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, Ellis won third prize in the 2007 RAWI Competition for Creative Prose. A longtime community activist, Ellis is co-author of Dealing with Differences, a diversity workbook published by Corwin Press in 1997. Hi, Anjel. How are you?
Fine, Jan. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, sure. Sure. I'm really excited about your book, Arab on Radar, and I know you've done a lot of readings from it. So we still want to hear some poems from it, though. A lot of our listeners may not know your work yet.
Thanks. I'm going to start with a title poem, which is a lapel grabber. I think it's the closest thing to a performance piece that I've written. It was first published in Misna, a national Arab American journal. Arab on Radar. Arab on Radar, the band poster said, an accusation, a declaration of secret identity. Arab, I hear in my grandfather's voice. Then Ahab the Arab, that novelty song of the 60s where the girlfriend whinnies like a camel. Very funny. By the guy who later sang that everyone is beautiful, but I guess he made a few exceptions. We usually said Lebanese, a measure of blamelessness until Beirut became a synonym for hell. Some preferred Phoenician, ancients and merchant ships with purple sails, anything to erase the hated word that brought us from whiteness to darkness. It was all about whiteness, trying to ignore the cartoon sheiks with their huge noses while we measured ours, praying they wouldn't get bigger. You're not Lebanese, said the bookstore clerk who recognized the golden cedar of Lebanon around my neck. Yes, I am. But you're so pale, he cried. Malcolm X had a vision of universal brotherhood, if not sisterhood, on his pilgrimage to Mecca. Hajis in every shade, from ivory to sable, but we were Christians, so that let us out. Sometimes we were taken for Jews, ironic recognition, Semite to Semite, or just another tired form of bigotry. My grandfather, slowly dying, speaking to me in Arabic from his hospital bed. My aunt saying, Bai, you know she doesn't understand. Your father should have taught you, he replied, in English as heavy as a punishment. But your father said to me, what do I need it for? What do I need it for now, except that the pain of denial persists like a blip on the screen of consciousness in every war, declared or silent. This next poem is called If We Live. It's dedicated to my friend and fellow writer John Rioli, and based on a conversation that we had. If We Live. To be of Arab descent is a practice of disassociation, you write. I read dislocation, wrenched identity, hanging limply from sorrow's shoulder. You write, I guess I always knew, but it was so unconscious. Our grandmothers counted their gold along the lengths of their arms. We spin ours from paper until dawn. If someone said our true names three times, cousin, would we flame and disappear? As if most Americans can distinguish the differences or even care to. Does every desperate act erase the differences, bring us closer to those in nameless cells, held by force of lawlessness or burning will? If we live, John, my grandfather said when anyone spoke of the future, if we live. This next poem is called Banadura. Banadura is the Arabic word for tomato, if you are Lebanese. Palestinian might say Bandora. It's another poem in which my grandfather appears. He seems to appear in a lot of my poems. I was just talking with a friend last night about The Wizard of Oz, and in some ways, if you know that movie, as so many people do, my grandfather was sort of like a Lebanese Professor Marvel, you know, a good man but a bad wizard. So this is Benadura. You need tomato seed from the old country, my grandfather said, cupping the hands of his 90s, verdigris and ochre, a map of two continents. Remember, I used to grow tomatoes, 4, 5, 6 bound. Pronouncing it bound, as we are to our deepest dreams. Miraculous, though not as large as Cinderella's pumpkin. New world to old world, reified, returning. Ripening exiles, almost too heavy for the stalk. I can't get the seed for you now. But maybe your father, his eyes dimmed and brightened, as when he said to guests, come back, now that you remember the road. Think of the tomato seed, so tough it will survive the acid twists of the digestive tract, the science of sewage processing. The seedlings rise stubbornly, again and again, from treated night earth. Here is your metaphor, the living flesh, the flavor of pure summer back to the original garden, the knowledge we were meant to devour. This next poem is called Paris of the Middle East. It was written in the summer of 2006, which was a summer of horrors for me because it was the summer of the Israeli bombing of Lebanon. And my uncle, who is a dean at Villanova and a Middle Eastern scholar, was trapped in Lebanon, along with 25,000 other Americans. And I was very concerned for him and also for my cousins, whom I visited there in 2000. Paris of the Middle East is another name for Beirut. Paris of the Middle East, 7-14-06. You wake with different eyes. Your history is blazing. Your cousins shut their ordinary lives. Your uncle folds his useless ticket. A face you glimpsed is shattered. A bridge you crossed is broken. They block the lines, but you get through to here. Darling, come next summer, God willing. In Goya's Disasters of War, the artist writes on his images, Yo lo vi, I saw it. No se puede mirar. One cannot look. In scene after scene, the eyes of the dead are opened. The tears of the universe are neither rain nor stars. They are bombs.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Angel Ellis. She's reading from her new book, Arab on Radar. I wanted to ask you, Angel, about the process of writing this book. Is it something that you always knew you wanted to write about, or is it something that came up organically when you would just sit down to write these poems? Arab on Radar just started arriving.
Well, this book is interesting because for years I was a drawer poet. I studied writing at the University of Pittsburgh, mostly nonfiction writing, which I think is good because when you study journalism, and I did work on the Pitt News, you learn to write concisely and grammatically, and then you can toss all those rules out when you become a poet. So I did have some poems that revised appear in this book, but after 9/11, I felt particularly compelled to write about my history and heritage to counteract some of the negative and distorted images that I saw in the media. And so some of the poems in this book, including the title poem, sprang from that impulse.
Well, how do you handle it then when you have a position, you have an agenda, which we all do, and how do you keep that out of the poems, so as not to hurt the poems, you know what I'm saying? Because if there's too much agenda, the poems can just fall flat.
You know, that's true. I think that if you are a poet who has been passionately involved in politics, it is difficult to write things that are not just polemical. I mean, I struggle with that all the time. I would hope that I don't forget that the poetry of the lines, you know, I first learned to love poetry from my mother, who was a great reciter of poems in her youth and who taught me poems. So the music of poetry is in my head. And also a sense of wanting to hit a human or unexpected note in poems and not merely write political polemics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you ever run into a point when you were writing Arab on Radar where that became challenging, or you wanted, you're passionate about a subject and you just wanted to get some things down in a certain way?
It did come up a number of times, because in the process of writing the book, of course, you know, writing is revision, as every writer knows. And of course, there are poems in the book that do not deal specifically with this topic. So there is some variety, and I'm going to be reading some different poems as well. But I think always to question, always to stop oneself. I mean, a poem is never finished, only abandoned, I guess, as Paul Valéry said. And I understand poets who go back and then want to revise earlier published work. I mean, you always look and think, I should have used this word, or I should have used that word. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I'm writing dishes, I think, no, I don't want this word, I want that mm-hmm. word. I'm mm-hmm. very into language. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's one of the things that saves me, I hope, from merely being strident, is my, you know, tremendous love for English,
right,
which is the only language I have, because I don't have my grandparents' language except for smatterings.
Okay.
English is my language.
Okay. Okay, could you read more?
Yes. This one is called Federal Building. It is the poem that is in the anthology Come Together, Imagine Peace, and it describes the Pittsburgh Federal Building after Oklahoma City, which, as we remember, was the largest act of domestic terrorism in our country's history, and sort of evokes earlier, perhaps more innocent days. Federal Building. I enter through security as taxpayer, the needle's eye of citizenship, bag on the table, keys in a plastic container that could hold mail or explosives, the only way in and out. I remember with strained nostalgia the protests of the 80s, South Africa, Nicaragua, El Salvador, the sit-ins at congressional offices, the time we rode up and down the elevators with our leaflets until the guards nabbed us and threw us out. And that last time, the sit-in during Desert Storm, suspended between freedom and arrest, swimming in ether like exotic fish, while our friends pressed against the aquarium glass with hopeful signs, as if we could change history, levitate the building, like Abby Hoffman tried with the Pentagon. Now we are lucky to stand unmolested on the public sidewalk, the thin edge of the wedge of democracy. This next poem is the poem that has the longest title of any poem that I've ever written. It's called On Hearing That FBI Anti-Terrorism Agents Spied on the Thomas Merton Center. And it's dedicated to Molly Moore Rush, the founder of the Thomas Merton Center. Pacifism is dangerous. Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk who rose above his seven-story mountain to the Buddhist peaks of Nepal, was electrocuted by a faulty fan while visiting the Dalai Lama. In his first and last filmed talk, he said, "Now I will disappear for a while, and we can all go get a Coke or something." And he did, yet reappears when anyone relives his revelation at Louisville's Fourth and Walnut. I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts. If only we could see each other that way all the time, there would be no more war. Beauty, the secret missed by surveillance, blacked out like lines in a classified file. unseen in those opposed to the U.S. war in Iraq, left wing, advocating many political causes, appearing to be of Middle Eastern descent. The war against terrorism makes the world blind to Merton's radical belief that if we truly saw, we might fall down and worship each other. Now freedom will disappear for a while, and we can all go get a Coke or something. I was recently reading at Stetson University in Florida, and a student asked me, "Don't you write any personal poems?" So this one is for him. It's called In Camera. The night you came back, Victorian floors made moan. You took your photograph, the one I cherished through three cities and nine houses. A gift is always on loan. Graven images turn hearts to stone. Rage shuddered my optic nerve. You left. Through a migraine filter, I focused on the naked wall and wept. Photographs are kept for the lie of a moment, captive light that warms. The college darkroom, the acid bath, your face emerging into form. Quicker than a flash, it snared me. For decades, held us fast. A random shot of innocence, caught once, never surpassed.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Angele Ellis. She's reading from her new book, Arab on Radar. Now, that question, don't you have anything personal? Don't you write any personal poems? You know, embedded in that could really be, you know, isn't this enough of this political talk? Or, you know, that idea of, you know, a lot of people don't want to see, don't want to be told about, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, do you run into any of that when you read your work? I mean, I'm not saying that's what that young man was saying, but...
You know, I do sometimes, but I think that any poet with a curious mind, to use an expression that I once heard you use, I think writes about a lot of different topics. There are so many things in our world that come into a poet's imagination. And I consider my political poems to be as deeply felt as my so-called personal poems, poems written out of experience of love and friendship and nature. To me, there's a continuity and a flow because my life has been changed by many things, by my personal relationships, by my family relationships, you know, what I've read, what I've seen, and also by my political engagement. So to me, it's all of a piece.
Right, right. You know, one thing I really like about your work is there's just such great immediacy and clarity in your work. And, you know, this precision of detail just delivers us wherever you want us to be. And, you know, is that something that you set out to do, that something you work on in revision, or, you know, how does that come from your prose writing, your journalism history?
I think it comes from the fact that sometimes I don't really know what I think or feel until I write about it. Mm-hmm. And in writing about it and rewriting it, I come to a clearer understanding of what the world means to me.
Mm-hmm. So that poetry as discovery thing really is in effect with you.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that's sort of what we're supposed to be doing, I think, is find out where we are, learn something along the way, and instead of, you know, hitting each other on the head with our ideas, you know.
Mm. Yeah. Which we're so tempted to do.
It can be fun sometimes. But why don't you read some more poems?
Well, I think that the question you just asked is a great segue into my next poem, which is called Okay. I've actually been reading so long that I don't really remember learning to read, but I do remember the first word I ever wrote. And since reading and writing are so central to my life, I wrote this poem, Okay, about that moment. The first word I read is gone, but the first word I wrote flows into meaning, like water into Helen Keller's palm. Mommy left a message on the chalkboard. Play quietly and be good. I was four. For the first time, I knew the need to reply in letters, who had never formed a word. My O was peaked, a mountain. My K had horizontal branches. Yet the universal yes, all right, already, ascended and ascended to the written world. Okay, I write now, facing sorrow. Okay, 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 okay.
Nice poem. Are you saying you really remember that? I have to ask. It's hard to believe.
I do remember it because I... my mother, you know, I'm the oldest of five children born very rapidly, you know, 5 and 6 years. And so at the time that this happened, I had, my mother was pregnant with my fourth sister, but I had a younger brother and sister, and she very rarely left us. But we were in the basement playing, and she didn't really leave. She hid in this little laundry annex so that she could see. She was trying to test whether I really knew how to read. And I think her absence and the message on the board, and then this passionate, burning desire I had to reply. Like, I could read, but I couldn't write, but I thought maybe I could manage those two letters, you know, okay.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I do, I remember how difficult, and, you know, I described this sort of scrawl, but I was writing for the first time, and you know, it was a great moment.
It's amazing. I can't remember anything like that, but I like to hear about it. So we have time for some more.
Now I'm going to read a few new poems from a manuscript tentatively titled In That Hour. This poem first appeared in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. It has a Pittsburgh twist, and it was workshopped in the Mad Women in the Attic workshops. It's called First Corinthians at Westview Park. They were called star cages, bobbing baskets, on the high tide of an upright whirling creel. The ride, clockwise, counterclockwise, mashed Fabian Mihalik and me together in the wire mesh. Mock making out, like the basement party game of balancing an orange in the hollow of two necks. How well matched we were. Smudged glasses, sharp breathing, skinny elbows, funny names. The spinning cotton candy sky, sticky flesh, made me sick. Afterward, I slumped on a bench while Fabian put his arm around me to comfort and caress. His fingers grazed the dart of my homemade cotton dress. I had bumps for breasts, no hips, no break in the falling starbursts over my knees, white on red. He was waiting to kiss me if I raised my head. Charity suffereth long and is kind, like the mixed motives of 13-year-olds. That is to say, anyone caught by love's dizzying wheel. This next poem is also a love poem, more recent. I had the opportunity to spend time in January at a writer's retreat in Costa Rica, courtesy of the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. I was reading Sharon Olds and very much missing my boyfriend, so I wrote this poem called Strike Sparks. 2 weeks ago, I felt an egg, smaller than a pearl of roe, roll down the old scarred string, pain striking like a lit cigarette along my left side. They are tough, this cluster of possibilities that I was born with, like the lovely bunch of coconuts I saw ripening in the fronds as I sat this morning with coffee on the lookout. Not yet brown, but burnt sienna, the deceptive blue Pacific stretching half a mile beyond. Below the steam of coffee, whiff of iron between my legs, ache of unused blood beating, redder than the inside of a mouth. Aching everywhere in my new bruised body, desire has sparked. Breast, tongue, womb, beating there like a second heart. Remembering your hot, drunken voice in my ear the night before I went, thrusting harder and harder inside you until we can't stand it anymore. Do you wonder why I tease you against wet lips each time, wanting you unsheathed, stripping desire to this primal reason for joining? My love, my unexpected mate, our poems are the children our smoldering matched bodies will never make. Awake now, we trade stories like infatuated Scheherazades, claiming 1,001 nights with intricate kisses, tracing intimate flares of narrative along throbbing veins. This poem appeared in the latest Encyclopedia Destructica, a really quite beautiful journal edited by Jerome Crooks, among others. And it's a favorite of mine because I've rewritten it so many times. It's called Silver Anniversary. With the edge of a carving knife, I scrape the face of our old mirror. Flurries of silver fall, sleeting the floorboards, turning to ice. As the layers build, silver turns transparent. Underneath, I see the shadow of your young self, moving forward like a shark, and then the startle of steel in your eyes. The little mermaid who sacrificed her voice for the legs that allowed her to dance follows you. Her twin blades of pain float uselessly behind her as puckered fingers brush the underside of the ice like whispers. I miss the watered sheen of our mirror world, fins that felt like kisses against my flesh, fluted holes in my neck where I grew gills so that I could breathe without surfacing. I drop the knife, lifting my hands to the great white scars that threaten to choke me. I wake, gasping, to a cold room, silver falling from the sky in gouts of rain.
It's the poetry of Ann Jo Ellis. We're out of time, Ann Jo. I just want to make sure that I mention that on June 16th, you're reading at Hemingway's in Oakland, and that's Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.